This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Today on Writer's Voice, an eclectic offering. Later in the show, we talk about eggs, actual, mythological, and artistic. Author Lizzie Stark tells us about her book, Egg. But first, we talk about media literacy, something that's vital if we are to preserve and strengthen democracy. We speak with Allison Butler about the book she co-wrote, The Media and Me, A Guide to Critical Media Literacy for Young People. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Young people are voracious media consumers. 8 to 18-year-olds pack in more than 11 hours of some form of media every day, often multitasking between a number of different media streams and screens. Yet how much do they really understand about how to consume media? The biases and manipulations that are part and parcel of the media landscape? Not so much. In fact, media literacy among young people is quite low. That's a lack my guest and her 9 co-authors seek to address with their terrific book for young people, high school age through college, and frankly, just as useful for grown-ups. Media and Me is a guide to critical media literacy, developed by a collective of writers brought together by Project Censored, an organization devoted to educating students and the public about the importance of a truly free press. The book gives readers critical inquiry skills, covering topics like storytelling, building arguments and recognizing fallacies, surveillance and digital gatekeeping, advertising and consumerism, among other issues. Allison Butler is director of the Media Literacy Certificate Program at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. I spoke with her at the end of March. Allison Butler, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much. I'm super excited to be here.
This was just a terrific book, The Media and Me, A Guide to Critical Media Literacy for Young People. First of all, I just want to ask you a little bit about Project Censored and the Media Revolution Collective. You know, there are 10 authors here. Tell us about that.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of us. So we thought it would be, with 10 authors, that it might be pretty cumbersome to list us all. And, you know, we're doing a lot of this work in and around the Project Censored organization, which promotes independent journalism. And so we decided that we would be a collective of authors, that we also really wanted to send the message that this was something written by a collective, not by individuals doing a sentence here or there. We started off with a smaller core group of authors, still a pretty big group, still 5 people. And then we put together a draft. We had some really good parts to it. And we also recognized that there were a lot of parts that were missing. As I said, it was really our motivation to be writing this directly to young people. And I think I'm confident in saying that the 5 initial authors are not young people. So we wanted to make sure that we were walking our talk, and we wanted to make sure that all of our authorship reflected the diversity that we were trying to address in the text. So we really expanded our work to include a variety of people to make sure that any reader can find themselves in this text.
And such an important text, especially as we are facing a brave new world of AI and the rising tide of authoritarianism, really, really terrifying. So tell us, you ask a question, how do we know what's true in the world? And you answer with it's critical media literacy, at least partly thereof. What is critical media literacy?
So if we take out the word critical for just a second, media literacy, as understood in the United States, is the ability to access, analyze, and produce a variety of media. When we break that down, we're talking about what kind of media do we get? Like, what comes to us? What do we seek out? What do we have in our homes in terms of access? Maybe what do we have in our classrooms? Certainly, there's a financial component to that, right? What are we willing or able to spend money on in order to access? Analyze is probably the biggest work. That's what we do when we're deconstructing the media, when we're looking at images or sounds or words. And then produce, when that definition first came to us in the 1990s, Produce was really focused on video production and providing young people with video production skills, looking at the creation, the construction of media as the hands-on construction of media as a way to better understand how other media are put together. Certainly in 2023, we're less concerned with camcorders and maybe more with our social media. Everything that we can do via our phones, our digitized media. Our work is critical media literacy. And by adding in that critical qualifier, we are really looking at an exploration of power. A lot of our work is looking behind the scenes. So while we think we think the content of media is incredibly important, and indeed we dedicate a whole chapter to representation, it's also about how that content got there. So we take a real political economic approach, looking at the process of ownership, production, and distribution. How did our media get to be this way? Who's in charge of it? And looking at the power dynamics there. To be critical, we always want to make sure to be clear about, isn't to dislike, to take a critical view of the media, isn't to bash it, it isn't to hate it, it isn't to point fingers and say anybody's doing anything, any viewer, any audience member is doing anything wrong. It's really to take a step back and try and look at our media texts as multidimensional objects and see them as full and complete and incredibly complicated things that deserve a lot of attention.
Yeah, and some of those things or themes that you explore are, as you say in the book, as you and your author say, meaning, access, representation, and validity. I want to set aside representation for now because I want to return to that a little bit later. But tell me, what do you mean by meaning? Let's start there.
So our media tell stories, right? I mean, as human beings, we are a storytelling species. This is how we've, in some ways, I would argue, this is sort of how we've managed to survive and ideally also to thrive is by sharing information. Our media shares information. Our media tell us stories. And in putting those pieces together that tell us a story, there is a meaning that is constructed from that. It gives us information, right or wrong, good or bad, accurate or inaccurate about the world. And then as audiences, we are invited to see ourselves or not in those stories. And so what we really want to do is try and have a better understanding of what meaning is imbued in the media and how we can both maybe to some extent understand that those stories are being told about us without actually the storytellers without actually necessarily knowing who we are, and that also there are different ways to create meaning and different stories can be told.
So let's talk about some of those. And I guess now I will talk about representation. You know, representation is an interesting word because what it applies to is the representation of often what have been marginalized groups now in the mainstream conversation. But your book, you know, as in real life, also in the media, the devil's in the details. Representation doesn't always mean accuracy. It doesn't always mean quality. You could have a lot of representation. I like to think in terms of politics that representation doesn't mean policy. I mean, you can have the difference between AOC, for example, and Condoleezza Rice or Margaret Thatcher. You know, so they're all women, but very vastly different in their impact on the world.
So, yeah, I mean, representation, I think, means at least two things and probably more like 2 million things. Representation is certainly what we see and how we see it. But representation can also be the absence of what we see. Who's missing? Whose stories aren't being told? When we start to look really closely at representation and we see whose stories are being told, part of our work is to do that behind the scenes and say, and how and by whom are those stories being told? But by looking at who's there, we'll also get an idea of who's not there, right? So in critical media literacy, the absence of data is data. Who's not being represented? Who's not, whose stories aren't being told? And then we have to kind of spend a little bit of time trying to figure out why those stories might not be told. And when, absolutely to your point, when we have a collection of representations that on some level appear to be about the same thing, how do we also see them as, in fact, being really, really different? You know, I mean, we have a history in our broadcast television and our narrative television programming of having predominantly white casts. And that is absolutely true. We can look at moments in history in our broadcast television where we've seen spike increases of representations of color, of bodies of color on mainstream television programs. But how are those bodies of color being represented? How are their stories being told? We have too much of a history of these stories being told as, you know, the fun sidekick, or of course, the criminal, the sort of wise friend who pops in and out, the support staff, as it were. That might have a quantity of representation, but it's absolutely not a quality of representation. So we also want to look at how those different stories are being told and how we have those different interactions between our characters. And we can certainly extend this beyond broadcast television, beyond entertainment. We can look at this with news, as you said, we can look at it with both politics and policy, that we want to look at, you know, what is there, what is not there, and then how are these stories being told?
So it seems to me that you have to bring in other factors of analysis to understand, let's say, that representation is truly representing the needs or interests of a community. What would some of those factors be?
That's a lot of where we get into the behind the scenes work. We really want to look and encourage our readers to look at how something gets produced. To look at the power structure of who is the writer, who's the director, who's the producer. When we're looking at our corporate media in the United States, the vast majority of what you and I watch, read, and listen to come to us from a really small number of corporations, and they're private, and their motivation, because we live in a capitalist culture, is profit. Their number one goal is profit. If you and I happen to be entertained or informed along the way, that's great. But really what they're looking at is profit. So a lot of the decisions that go into making texts, the decisions that go into the writing, into the producing, into the distribution, are largely about what is perceived, what is believed to be the most profitable. And there are certain types of stories, certain tropes that are considered to be guaranteed audience, to use guarantee very carefully, of course. And that's part of what we really want to undo. You know, you can look at, for example, again, speaking specifically about entertainment media, we can look at the Black Panther part of the Marvel enterprise. And when Black Panther, the first Black Panther, when it was being put up for production, the thought was it could never happen because it's a primarily Black cast and white audiences won't go see that. It broke box office records. It had a Black writer, Black producer, Black production team, predominantly Black cast, Black named characters in a multiplicity of roles, and it broke box office records. Then we have, of course, COVID, which changes entirely how we go to the movies and how we watch TV and all that sort of stuff. When Wakanda Forever, the second in the Black Panther franchise, comes out, it is labeled as this is the movie that's going to get us going back to the theaters. And again, it broke box office records with a predominantly Black cast, Black writers, Black producers, Black production staff. So while we have this perception, or maybe an outdated perception, certainly, that there's only going to be certain types of content that get audiences, we see that being disproven. And that's part of the work that we want to do. We want to look at that and say, what does it mean to have this disprove expectations? What happens when we look at primarily a cast of color that is reaching predominantly white audiences? How can we understand this as an incredibly complex and complicated set of stories?
And now we have, I mean, talking about the issue of access, we have really a time of an assault on access. And that's coming from Ron DeSantis and he and others, the GOP, their anti, quote, woke, unquote, campaign. I mean, just as an aside, why would you not want to be awake? I don't get it. Talk about the assault on access to these stories of expanded representation.
Yeah, we are living in dark times, and I would be delusional to say that we weren't. And I agree with you. The idea of not being awake as like something to be proud of leaves me deeply, deeply concerned. But it's also it's so much in how our stories are framed. It's so much in how the messages are framed. And it is so much in how what is perceived to, again, be making money or making votes. I don't want to let Ron DeSantis off the hook by any stretch of the imagination. But there is something to be said that for the most part, you and I probably only know him as a public figure versus knowing him as a private individual. And this seems to be what his team thinks his public persona should be. And I think that needs to be dug into. But you're right. I mean, I was reading today about the horrible tragedy of the shooting in Nashville. And I try to read, I read the press that I tend to sort of support or believe in, but I also try and make it a project to read the press that I disagree with. I want to see what else is being written about that. And to the, you know, to the question of access, what can I read that I don't, what can I start to read and maybe not be able to finish because I run into a paywall, right? There's a form of access, whether or not I can actually read about something. And, you know, sometimes I think it is absolutely worth my money to pay for something so that I can learn more about it. But it is somewhere where we might need to pause and say, what does a paywall mean? But some of the opposition press that I was able to read today that did not ever want my money, did not want my dollars at all, opened me up to a whole different way of understanding this shooting. That it is one piece that I was reading was talking about the mental health crisis. And I was like, okay, I got you. Let's go. And the next sentence was perpetuated by LGBTQ people and perpetuated by trans people, that it is their outrageous demands that are causing this crisis. And that's where I, you know, I had to pause and sort of breathe deeply because I'm in my office and I have to be responsible and a grown-up. But this is how our stories get framed. And when you and I have potentially limited availability, if, for example, the only news outlet that doesn't come with a paywall is going to be spouting forth this kind of rhetoric, it is going to be really hard to believe or try and learn something else. So we really have to think, I think, very carefully, very cautiously, not only about what is being said and how it is being said, but through what medium and with what ability to gain access to that medium.
And we are talking with Allison Butler, who is the director of the Media Literacy Certificate Program at UMass Amherst and is also a co-author on the book The Media and Me, A Guide to Critical Media Literacy for Young People. This book is directed, I mean, although it's great for grown-ups also, it's directed towards kids. You have a figure on here that I was actually even surprised at, that 8 to 18-year-olds pack more than 11 hours with some form of media into every day by media multitasking, and yet they tend not to be media literate. So how do you explain that? Because as we're talking, I mean, they have access to way more information than certainly I ever did growing up. And yet I know from my granddaughter, who I love dearly, and she's very bright, but sometimes I'm struck by her naivete when it comes to consuming media, although she hates TikTok.
Well, I mean, excellent. You know, it's so funny. I think once we lump in you know, especially generational arguments, you know, kids these days and their phone use, and they're just always on these social media sites. And then you actually talk to young people and they're like, nah, like you said, your granddaughter hates TikTok, isn't interested in it. I think, you know, as the elderly, the grownups, middle-aged folks, whatever, we need to maybe be a little bit more cautious about how we lump together young people. But I think the idea behind the media multitasking is that they can, any one of us can be on any kind of content and be simultaneously on other content, right? We can be watching something on YouTube while texting with our friends. And maybe part of what we're texting about is the video that we're watching on YouTube, but it could also be the thing that we're looking at on Instagram or something that we're retweeting on Twitter or so on and so forth. So yeah, we just have the ability to do you know, we were presented, I should say, more carefully. We are presented with the ability to do so many things at once. Media multitasking, any kind of multitasking, is in fact not exactly true. Our brains are really doing one thing at a time. Our brains are just so adept at doing it quickly. But I think to your point about how much time young people or any of us might be on the media and yet not be terribly well informed is so much of our social media these days, so much of our digitized media encourages us to just kind of zip through, right? I mean, it's so easy if you want to go on any of those sites, TikTok, Instagram, any one of them, Twitter, and just thumb through, right? Just very quickly thumb through. And what you might see is a headline, what you might see is something intriguing, but you might not necessarily be reading much beyond the headline. And therefore, you have a lot of information, but you're not necessarily well informed. And I think it's important to remember that Twitter is not journalism, right? Journalists may post on Twitter, but Twitter in and of itself is not a source of journalism. So we want to think about like what happens when we are scrolling through, how much time can we spend or waste, depending on your perception of it, by just zipping through all of these different images or maybe these different headlines. I see that in my classes all the time. I ask them to really pause and take some time with this. I have them document for 24 hours their media use, and it is predominantly them. It almost always results in them coming to class and talking about feeling ashamed or feeling guilty or feeling bad about actually writing down how much time they spend on these sites. But in their defense, and they acknowledge it, they say that it is stressful, it is anxiety producing, and yet it's the world that they live in. It's where their friends are. And most of my students this semester are seniors, so they'll be graduating. They are graduating into a professional workforce that expects them to know how to use these sites. And they would be putting themselves at a professional disservice if they didn't. So they are caught in a bind, and they recognize that they're caught in a bind and haven't quite figured out maybe a way to move beyond that yet.
So, Allison Butler, what does the media and me suggest to these young people whose, let's say, their information is degraded by superficiality because it's forced superficiality? It's the algorithm that keeps on trying to, you know, keep their eyeballs glued to the screen with every new little shot of dopamine that comes with a new tweet. So on the one hand, there's superficiality, and on the other hand, there is, you know, again, the algorithms that are, as the book points out, are pitched towards emotion, not reason.
So we don't want to think of this book as, I mean, we don't want to think of this book in any way, shape, or form as all doom and gloom, right? We recognize that a lot of people, ourselves included, get a great deal of joy out of our entertainment and information media. What we do want to encourage people is to try and look a little bit more closely and a little bit more carefully at their own choices. So to my point before about how social media encourages us to zip by, one of the pieces of advice that we provide at the end of the text is slow down. right? Don't let it zip on by. Really try and concentrate. What is it that you're looking at? What is it that is interesting to you? What is it that you are being told? You don't necessarily have to believe it, but if we zip through, then we're not concentrating. So we're saying, hey, take a few moments to just slow down, right? If you're finding, we're also encouraging our readers, like if you're finding yourself frustrated with the media that are available to you, try and seek out other media. What's out there that's independent? What's out there that's not part of a larger corporate conglomerate? Or if all you have available to you is corporate news or corporate information, what can you learn more about that corporation in order to kind of better understand what their motivation and their messaging are? We always encourage people to try and pay attention to their local media. What's happening in your community, right? So much of our corporate media treats us as this kind of monolithic body across the United States with all sorts of awkward references to the real America. What exactly is the real America? And that is important, and it's probably really valuable, but also what's going on in your community? What's going on in your neighborhood where you might have more of a stake in that? And then how can we begin to understand ourselves as community-oriented folks, which might help us understand how we live in the world? Naming it, you know, sometimes even just changing our vocabulary so that we're actually naming as opposed to talking about the mysterious they who are making these decisions or how that comes to us. Let's try and figure out, even if we don't have the correct vocabulary, even if we have to really struggle, but trying to name who is making these decisions and in whose interest can help us just take back a little bit of control, right? I mean, many of my students will talk about putting the timers on their phones or the do not disturb on their phones so that they can kind of regulate their own use. What about just doing that on our own? Because anytime we use anything on our phone, it serves our data mining and it serves that algorithm. So instead of letting our phone dictate to us when to be used, how about if we take control of that and say, I'm going to just go look at my pics or I'm going to go look at my social media when I choose to, not when my phone pings me. So just a little bit more of our own self-control could also be a way to sort of stem some of this overwhelming tide.
Well, let's talk about journalism because, yes, slow down. And in fact, I do use Twitter, by the way, mostly to help me link to articles, you know, to point out articles that I should link to so I can think more deeply about things. But on the other hand, you know, there's plenty of journalistic bias. And so deconstruct bias in journalism. Tell us what are some of the things that we need to keep in mind when reading a news story?
Well, I mean, one of the tenets of journalism is the striving for objectivity, right? Journalists are striving for objectivity, but I think the key word there is striving. We are humans. We are going to make mistakes. Making honest mistakes is a lot different than malinformation or lying or quote unquote fake news. I mean, fake news was something that was weaponized by the previous administration just to call out stuff that they didn't like. That doesn't necessarily make it fake. It just means it's something that you don't like. So, you know, you want to think about as a reader of news, I would really recommend until you start to become really familiar with a news outlet, step away from the content right away. Think about where is this coming from? What can you learn about the author? What can you learn about the journalist? Who owns this site or who owns this news source and what might their motivations be? What are they telling us about their company or about their motivations? That can give us insight before we even start reading the content, that we might be able to get an idea of how this is going to be presented to us. And also, when possible, this is asking a lot, obviously, many of our days are probably too busy for this, but when possible, read what you disagree with. It's super hard with the algorithm. If most of us are getting our news digitally versus that newspaper coming to our front stoop every morning, once we start to build up that digital footprint, the algorithm within the systems are going to send us more of what we already believe in. So we actually have to do a little bit of work to find stuff that might be unfamiliar or with which we might disagree. Do a little bit of that work. And then you can start to, I think we start to understand our own beliefs better by reading things or listening to things or watching things that we might not necessarily agree with. You know, journalism is certainly not without flaws, but if we really kind of want to break it down, the news is a report on change. It's telling us something different that happened, but we can't read about or report on every single different thing that's happening in the day. It's overwhelming. So journalists and news organizations, they're picking out stories. They're picking out what is perceived to be the most important. That's one reason why I would argue for looking at your local community, because that might be different. What's happening in your town might be something different in addition to what's happening in the United States or what's happening around the globe. So it's, you know, part of our work is to try and look at our news both as the content, but as well as the larger context. Where is this story coming from and how is it situated? If I can understand the larger context, I might have a better idea of how to approach the content.
I would also add, who does the story benefit?
Correct. 100%. 100%. And we know that in a private corporate media, the benefit is going to be the person who stands to profit the most. And then we also have to think about what role we might play in being seen as an audience member and what is being presumed about us.
Well, that's a great answer. And I'm sorry that we've come to the end of our time, but this has really been fascinating. It's really a terrific book. I think it should be mandated reading, especially in Florida.
I agree with you. Let's do it.
Okay.
Thanks so much.
Allison Butler is director of the Media Literacy Certificate Program at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Find a link to the Project Censored website at writersvoice.net. Next up, eggs, cosmic and otherwise. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to find more great content, including web-only features like interview transcripts and extended interviews. The egg is an object so common, so ubiquitous, and I'm talking eggs of all types, that most of us probably don't think much about it, unless we're planning to cook it, usually in its chicken-derived form. But the egg is a powerful symbol in mythology, an object of art, and not just for Easter, a concern of prospective parents, and even a target for crime. My guest Lizzie Stark's book, Egg, A Dozen Overtures, lays out an unconventional history of this cellular workhorse, from chickens to penguins, from art to crime, and more. Lizzie Stark, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks so much for having me.
Egg, A Dozen Overtures, that's OVATURES. This was a far more interesting book than I thought it might be from the beginning. You really range wide over the topics, all about one of our favorite foods, the egg. You say the egg is a paradox. It's both alive and not alive. Could you say more about that?
Sure. An egg occupies the middle state between alive and dead. You can see the way this comes out in some world religions and the ways they treat food. So, for example, in Judaism, eggs are considered pareve for kosher purposes, which means that you can eat them with a milk meal, but you can also eat them with a meat meal. And so I thought that was kind of interesting. It implies that eggs are both meat, but also not quite meat. And the same thing for medieval Catholicism. Early on, eggs were not part of the fasting diet that people would enjoy during many days of the year, including during the 40 days of Lent. So for much of Christian history, eggs were prohibited along with meat. But then in the mid-1500s, the decision was reversed, and now eggs are permitted on fasting days. So I think that's kind of interesting. And you can also see the way that comes out in current debates over abortion. Is a fertilized egg fully human, or is it just a clump of cells? And I think the reality is a little bit more complex, and that's that it's somewhere in between. It's in the in-between state.
And that is a momentous issue right now. Your book, as I said before, it ranges widely, but it really starts with you. When you were 27, you found out that you shared your mother's BRCA1 gene, and you discovered that you were at higher risk for breast or ovarian cancer. Talk about the link between that and writing this book, your personal connection.
Well, when I sat down to write this book about eggs, I actually got pretty far into it before figuring out that I had this very personal bodily connection to the topic. You know, when I got the book contract, I knew that the days of me and my ovaries being part of the same body were just about concluded. And it was during the course of writing the book that I made the decision to remove them. The doctors told me that I needed to do this after childbearing was completed or before age 40, whichever came first. So I was kind of creeping up on that 40th birthday, and I figured, you know, there's never a good time to have elective surgery to remove some of your body parts. And so I might as well just go ahead and do it. But it really took, you know, one day I literally woke up and I thought, oh, I'm removing my ovaries and I'm also writing a book about eggs at the same time. Maybe these two things are connected. And I think for sure in my psyche, somehow that element was always there. But my other connection to eggs is a connection to my father and the way that he taught me to cook growing up. You know, I used to take these swimming lessons on Saturdays. And afterward, my dad would give me a lesson in how to make breakfasts because he's always loved to cook and he's probably the person in the family who loves it the most. And he wanted to inculcate me, indoctrinate me, absorb me into the family tradition. And so a lot of our early cooking experiments together were with eggs, which are really an excellent way to teach a young person both how to cook and the power of prototyping. Even now, when eggs are, you know, at a historic high for expense, or certainly, you know, they cost more than they've cost in the last 5 years, they're still among the cheapest protein I think you can buy at the store. And so bringing home a stack and riffing your way through a couple cartons on your way to learning to make the perfect omelet or the perfect fried egg or the perfect scramble, that's a pretty easy experiment to do with a kid. And it's also a delicious experiment because even if you screw up an egg, it usually tastes pretty good.
I love the parts where you talk about your dad and his relationship to you through cooking. So often we get a different picture of dads than the one you paint. And I just thought it was really heartwarming and quite wonderful. Now, talk about the egg as a symbol. You write about the cosmic egg, the origin story or you know, the concept that infuses so many origin stories. What are some of the common themes of those stories? What is the cosmic egg?
One of the common themes is that nobody seems to know about the cosmic egg. I mean, I consider myself a pretty hardcore story person. I've always loved myths, and I have no memory of the cosmic egg before I started researching for this book. The cosmic egg is a motif that is so common in world myth that mythologists gave it that name, the cosmic egg. So it's the egg that exists at the very, very start of the world before almost anything else. And I would say there are two general categories of cosmic egg myth. The first of them is represented by the Finnish origin story from the Kalevala, which is a collection of Finnish poetry and mythology set down in the mid-1800s. But the book opens with a story about the Mother of Waters just existing on her own and being kind of lonely until one day she notices this duck flying above her. And the duck is circling and circling, and there's no land yet. So the Mother of Waters lifts up her leg, bends her leg, and the duck flies down and builds a nest on top of it. And into the nest go 6 gold eggs and an iron one. And then as the duck incubates the eggs get hot, and this burns the Mother of Waters. And she shakes her leg a little bit to relieve the heat. And when she does that, the eggs roll down her leg and break, and they let out everything in existence. The shells become the dome of the sky, and the yolk becomes the sun, and the egg white becomes the moon, and the speckling on the egg's shells becomes the Milky Way, and so on. So that's one version of cosmic egg myth. And in the other version of cosmic egg myth, it's a little bit the same. The egg breaks and lets out everything in creation, but rather than letting out everything in creation directly, instead it lets out a entity that creates everything in existence. So in China, Pan Ku comes out of the cosmic egg and builds the world with his ads. And in Tahitian myth, it's Taura who comes out of the cosmic egg. And Taura gives his body to become the earth. So, you know, his fingernails become the scales of the fish, and his strength becomes the mountains, and so on and so forth. So the egg is the magical origin of everything in these stories. And I think it's not a mistake by ancient people, because anybody who's watched an egg hatch knows that it is a little bit magical.
Yeah, and one of the myths, is it the Tahitian one, that I found so interesting is that there is a binary interpretation of eggs, both male and female. I wonder if you could talk about that and, you know, what struck you when you found out about it?
This is the Dogon myth. The Dogon myth is a little complicated. So the creation myth begins with an egg fertilized by the supreme being, who is referred to as a he, but contains both male and female elements. And that's pretty common throughout this sort of cosmic egg myth, that the creator of the world is in some way a little bit androgynous. So the universe shakes up Emma's egg 7 times, and all of that shaking makes 2 compartments inside the egg, and each of those compartments has a male-female pair of twins. And each twin is kind of like Emma in its androgyny. So eventually one of the twins breaks free, and he dislodges a piece of placenta when he does that, and that becomes the earth. And he tries to go back to the egg, but he can't find his twin sister there because she's been put into the placenta with the other pair of twins. And eventually the gods release, Emma releases all of the twins down onto earth where they copulate and produce humanity. And so this myth interested me both because I've been to the region where it's from. I've traveled on the Dogon Escarpment, which is down the middle of Mali and Burkina Faso many years ago. But also because there are these themes of androgyny and multiplicity, just the fact that there are several placentas inside the egg. It speaks to me of the multiplicity of creation, the amazing variety of creation.
And we are talking with Lizzie Stark about her book, Egg, A Dozen Overtures. So you mentioned cooking with your father. You had a conversation with the great chef Jacques Pepin. Talk to us a little bit about you know, your experience with him. I follow this closely because I had eggs this morning and I had just learned for the first time in my life, I can't believe it took me this long, how to do scrambled eggs so that they come out nice and creamy and not too hard or too runny. So this was of great interest to me.
So I grew up watching Jacques Pepin. He was, you know, he was a god in my household. And frequently my dad and I would spend our weekends watching Jacques Pepin or Julia Child, or preferably Julia Child and Jacques Pepin in the greatest cooking show ever made, which is Cooking at Home with Julia and Jacques. And we would watch them make something, and then we would go to the grocery store and go into our own kitchen and try to make it. So I grew up with Jacques being like my TV dad. You know, we have all the Jacques books. I consult his complete techniques on the regular. This is his book where he shows you how to do kind of any basic kitchen thing you would want to do, from poaching an egg to deboning a rabbit and filling it with, you know, pate or something. Anyway, so I know that Jacques Pepin knows everything there is to know about eggs, pretty much. And I really wanted to talk to him, but I just assumed it was impossible because, like, he's my TV dad. And then I was talking to a culinary historian who suggested that I get in contact. And so I got his email and I sent him an email, and I nearly died when his assistant emailed me back to say that we were going to be able to talk. And then there we had a little snafu with the scheduling. And so Jacques ended up just calling me out of the blue with no warning. And it was the, you know, it was one of the most delightful phone calls of my life, because I'd been training practically from birth, I would say, to talk to Jacques Pepin about eggs. And I was particularly interested in learning about fancy eggs that he might have made. You know, we think of the egg as a humble ingredient. And I had done some research looking at haute cuisine restaurants, and were they serving eggs and how were they serving eggs? And I hadn't come up with any satisfying conclusions, I guess. Most places were serving, you know, a lobster frittata with gold on top of it. And to me, that preparation is still pretty humble. It's just eggs and cream, but it's the added ingredients that make it fancy. So I was wondering if there was a way of treating the egg to make it fancy. And, you know, Jacques Pepin has cooked for a number of heads of state over the years. He was the chef at France's first residence for quite a long time. And so he had lots of ideas for me. Among them, deep fried egg. You drop an egg into hot oil and you fry it runny and then put that on toast. So it was really great to talk to him and to learn a little bit about not just the fancy egg dishes he's made for other people, but about the egg dishes he makes for his family, because he is very connected to egg cookery, you know, from the very beginning. He grew up in a small town, France, during World War II, and there just wasn't a lot of food around. So eggs were their main source of protein. His mom kept a few chickens. And so for dinner, many nights, they would have hard-boiled eggs that had some kind of bechamel over them. So that's just like a basic white sauce thickened up with flour. And then you'd run that under the broiler and you'd have it with whatever vegetables you had on hand. And so that's something I've never thought about doing, but that I tried while I was working on the book. And it, you know, it's just incredibly homey and satisfying. And for all that you can make eggs fancy, I guess one of the questions is why, because they're just so good when they're done simply and at home in a soft scramble.
Now, there's a whole other aspect, too, of eggs as art. There are painted eggs, you know, the fancy Ukrainian painted eggs, for example, for Easter, clown eggs, and eggs used by artists like Milo Moire in Plop Egg and Sarah Lucas. I wonder if you could tell us about those two artists and how they used eggs.
Oh, I would love to. This was one of the most fun chapters to report. So Mila More is a conceptual artist who has this series called Plop Egg. And in it, she makes these paintings in public. And the video that I saw of one of them at an art festival in, I think, Berlin, maybe the Berlin Biennale, she is high up on this platform that has a little skirt around it. And you can't really see what she's doing. She's naked. And then her assistant wheels the platform away and she walks out on these two boards that are kind of on top of some sawhorses. And then she squats and lays an egg filled with paint down onto canvas below to make a kind of splatter painting. And so by repeating that many times, there's a lovely pattern that is made. And then she folded the canvas in half and squeegeed it to make a reverse imprint on the other side. And I found that very surprisingly moving to watch because she was so alone and vulnerable in this enormous, you know, brutalist plaza. Everybody who's watching her was cozied up for fall, but she, of course, was quite naked. And she looked very solemn and, you know, I want to say almost religious as she was doing this. And I first encountered her work through a total pan of the performance in a newspaper. And that just struck me as missing the point, I guess. The critic had used her performance to talk about why performance art is so silly. And I thought, you know, art's really in the eye of the beholder. And this guy was not the intended audience, I suspect, for a piece like this. But as a woman who has given birth, I found it to be very affecting to watch. And then kind of on the other side of things, we have Sarah Lucas, who is a British artist who's been making work for quite a long time. And her work often features eggs, and it's just so playful, but also solemn and serious. There's a classic text of play studies that talks about how when you play with a thing, you can be completely serious while also being completely playful and funny. And I find that Sarah Lucas's work really exemplifies that. One of her most famous pieces is a self-portrait of herself in black and white. It's a photograph, and she looks very, like, I would say mask or like hard femme. She's has this short haircut. She's slouched back in a chair in jeans, and she has just a simple white t-shirt on. And then on top of her breasts are two fried eggs. And it's supposed to be a visual pun. I guess in Britain, fried eggs are slang for small breasts, which Lucas has. And so her gaze is, I think, really the thing that sells the painting. She just looks so defiant. Like, she knows she's being a little funny. She knows she's being perhaps a little bit coy about the meaning of the painting, but she's also daring you with her eyes to, you know, to step to her, basically. And I found that just so intriguing to look at. And that's far from her only egg-based artwork. And I write about a couple of them in the book, but I probably spend the most time on her piece, 1,000 Eggs for Women. And it's been put up, I think, two or three times, maybe more, in art galleries around the world. And the deal is, she rolls up with 1,000 eggs. There's a crowd assembled in this art gallery. There's a specially treated gallery wall. And she gives everybody a little art lesson, like, I'm going to let you throw these eggs in a minute. But when you're throwing them, I want you to cover the whole wall evenly. And, like, don't be a showboat. Don't be just throwing one egg after another. Like, take a pause and think about where you're trying to hit with this egg. And then after that, women or anybody wearing one one article of traditionally feminine clothing is invited to come up and throw eggs at this wall. And it just looked like so much fun. I saw footage of one of the performances in, I think, an art gallery in Germany, where she had gotten a string quartet to come and play very solemn classical music as people were hurling eggs at a wall. And it's memorable, both for its fun and for its participatory nature. Also, I think because women are not supposed to get angry like that, and women are not supposed to be messy and leave that mess for somebody else to clean up. So she was really doing something kind of interesting with gender roles. And it was cathartic just to watch this performance happen. To watch it is, for me, was just a wish that I could have been there. So really an interesting work of art. And she has a lot more egg-based pieces out there. Someday my dream is to go to the UK, somehow meet Sarah Lucas, collect a few flats of eggs and, go to town.
That's great.
I'm pretty sure I'm not the only one with that fantasy, but,
That's wonderful. Well, there's much more in this book than we have time to cover, but in the minute or so that we have left, I'd like to ask you about something you say at the end of the book. You harvested your eggs when you had your ovaries taken out, and you say that through the absence of your own eggs, you've come to understand them better and perhaps love them even more. What do you mean by that?
It's an interesting thing that you can love something in its absence. I don't regret cutting my ovaries out, but I do miss some of the things ovaries did for my body, like provide it with a steady stream of estrogen and other hormones. That's one thing. And also, now that my ovaries are out, I don't have to worry about pregnancy, for example, or having a period. And I don't miss those things exactly, but it represents a shift in how I consider my day-to-day life and how I consider my own body. There's less to think about. But of course, the reason there's less to think about is that my body can no longer produce new life. So I guess through having my ovaries removed, I learned that what an awesome responsibility it is actually to have them in the first place. And it was the lifting of the responsibility with this ovarectomy that allowed me to understand that.
Well, that's a powerful statement. Lizzie Stark, your book is Egg, A Dozen Overtures. It's just been delightful to talk with you about it, and it was a delightful read.
Oh, thanks so much, Francesca. This was a lot of fun.
In addition to Egg, Lizzie Stark is the author of two other nonfiction books, Pandora's DNA and Leaving Mundania. Her writing has been featured in The Washington Post, The Daily Beast, and The Philadelphia Inquirer, among other publications. Next week on Writer's Voice, we talk with Peggy Orenstein about her book, Unraveling, What I Learned About Life While Shearing Sheep, Dyeing Wool, and Making the World's Ugliest Sweater. Also, novelist Katie Simpson Smith tells us about her new work of fiction, Weeds. Don't miss it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.